Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.
It's a marvelous night for a moon dance with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance beneath the cover of October skies.
What's up, everybody? Welcome aboard to the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz. And as you know, I always bring on the best guests in the world. And today we're going across the ocean and we're getting our buddy, Dr. Bob Swarup from Camdor Global, also an author of Money Boom. I'm going to get the exact name, but he's written a couple of books, and he's an economist, and I don't know why he turned me into the economy into the Fed, but he's going to tell us everything. Dr. Bob, welcome aboard to the show, man.
Todd, always a pleasure to be on.
So, Bob, I mean, first of all, let's talk, I guess, probably the number one thing on everybody's mind, and you're right in the center of it right now. We would call that, I guess, Brexit. What the hell's going on over there?
Well, you know what? I see the latest chapter in this saga of what you might call economic nationalism, right? I mean, let's put it this way. I mean, Europe, no matter which way you look at it, is a failed project. In its current form, it hasn't worked. You've got too many countries that are at opposite ends of the spectrum. They're in different directions. They've got too much debt and lots of issues out here. And Brexit is probably the latest evidence of this. The question really becomes is, do you choose to let Europe die rather chaotically and catastrophically on the 23rd of June by voting to leave, or do you let it die a little more slowly, the Holy Roman Empire, by to stay? So it's a challenge for out here, but you know, to be honest, I think it's actually not so much a decision point that's a point in time. It's a signpost on a longer journey.
So, you know, I mean, I don't know what it really means in the big scheme of life. I mean, here's my theory. Did you ever read The Creature from Jekyll Island?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Well, that's written and that's done from the other side of our Federal Reserve banks or a national banking system, which, of course, you guys started in the 1600s and ruined everybody. But, you know, It to me, this is just another step in creating a national worldwide socialism view, which I find kind of disturbing. But I want to get your views on, you know, the central banking system and why, because I think it's more of a mess. And when you allow them to continue to create money magically out of thin air, that becomes a much bigger problem over time, unless you're among the very wealthy. What do you say?
No, I agree with you. I mean, I think the problem you have here anyway, central bankers have kind of run out of options a long time ago. I mean, what amazes me is, you know, I did this chart back in March where I showed the amount of negative bond yields that were out there in the world. It was about $6 trillion back then. Now, as of today, you've got about $10.5 trillion of bonds with negative yields. It's amazing. And what it tells you actually is that these guys don't really know what they're doing anymore. I mean, you know, they're just throwing money at a problem. And they're trying more and more unconventional measures. I mean, you know, we went to Twilight Zone, we went way past Twilight Zone now. And no one really knows where this ends. I mean, if you're a central banker, I mean, think about it this way. The crisis is back in 2007 to 2009. We are now in 2016. Give it another year, we'll be back to a decade from when the crisis began. Now, Western Europe for the last 400 years has had a crisis every 10 years on average. So guess what? It's 10 years on next year. We're probably due another crisis, and somehow this last one hasn't even finished yet. So it's remarkable. And what it tells you is that what people haven't realized actually is that it's not about, you know, rescuing productivity or wage growth or employment and all this kind of bullshit. Actually, what it comes down to is there's far too much debt in the system, and no one has yet addressed that fundamental problem. I mean, if you look at the global debt markets back in 1990, global debt markets were $10 trillion in size. And that's not my numbers. Those are numbers from the Bank of National Settlements. 2015, those debt markets are $100 trillion in size. So you're talking about a 10 times increase in size over 25 years. And GDP globally has not gone up by 10 times in those 25 years. So what you have is a far more leveraged system with lots more debt and a lot more fragility. And no amount of throwing money at the problem solves that unless you deal with the debt.
Well, and again, this has been my argument. Now, I'm not an economist. You are, okay? But in my opinion, and I love you, so don't take this the wrong way, okay? Well, no, I mean, you and I talked many times, so I get you. You get it as far as I'm concerned. You get the big picture, and you understand it. But most economists don't understand the big picture, and they need to wait till the problem happens to address the problem. When you and I are talking right now, we know the problem is there's too much debt, and you can't buy your way or borrow your way out of a debt model. You have to satisfy that debt. But the way they do it now is it's really a legalized Ponzi scheme because central bankers and the Fed, they have the ability to print more money to satisfy the old debt while they're building new debt, which is going to create a bigger crisis down the road. And it's really getting really what it's doing. It's destroying the middle class across the globe. What do you say?
No, you're right. I mean, economists don't really understand any of the concept of debt, to be fair. I think most of them, the problem is they don't really actually understand financial markets. So for them, debt, equity, different bits of capital structure, it all blends into one thing. So the result is that to them, it's just become some form of capital. And they don't understand the difference between it. The problem you have with debt is that it's an obligation to pay someone. As a company, you're now sacrificing precious cash flow that is going to go away towards some unknown debt master somewhere out there for individual student loan, housing, whatever. And the problem you have, you look around Europe, for example, and Europe's supposed to be a prime example of it, but even around the US and elsewhere, this feeling of inequality and disenfranchisement isn't actually a socialist phenomenon by the bankers and things like that. It actually reflects the fact there's way too much debt in the system. And a lot of these people no longer feel they've controlled their lives. And central bankers and economists don't really understand that. Most economists somehow believe that somehow if they can just, you know, pump enough money in the system, they will get it back to the right. And what they don't understand is that there's a human psychology element to this, which affects all of that. So the debt is very real. It affects everyone. You know, if you go look around, you know, why is Trump so popular? Why is Bernie Sanders popular? What's very interesting is that whether you support Trump or Sanders, both of them are arguing for American jobs and protectionism of one sort or the other. Why? Because actually what they're catering to is a vote bank is increasingly feeling as they're no longer in control of their lives. So again, it comes back to a debt problem. I mean, in fact, the situation to me is very, very similar to the 1920s when a lot of the countries in Europe had way too much debt, didn't know how to deal with it, but they were unwilling to write it down. And this is the problem. You know, it amazes me that after all these decades of, within quotes, progress and technology and all the rest of it, we have a bankruptcy code for individuals. We have a bankruptcy code for companies. We still lack a bankruptcy code for sovereigns, and we need one.
You know what? See, and my words here on the show always are, Bob, is that if you or I did what the central banks are doing, we'd be in bankruptcy court in jail. Because, again, what we're seeing happening here is not good, and it is about debt, and nobody gets the debt issue, and sometimes you just have to take the beating and let the economy fail so that it can come back stronger. But when you continue to try to put what I call a Band-Aid on a tourniquet, a Band-Aid on a wound that needs a tourniquet, you're not going to solve the problem. All they're doing is delaying, and you and I both know that the explosion that's going to come out of this is going to be so much greater than what we could have done had we taken care of it right away. But anyways, we're with Dr. Bob Swarup from Camdor Global, also the author of Asset Liability Management for Financial Institutions and Money Mania, Booms and Panics and Busts, and there's more to that. But he's going to tell us about the booms and the busts because I think he believes we're probably going to have a bust here coming up pretty soon. In the meantime, if you ever miss an episode and you want to hear great guests like Dr. Bob Swarup from Camdor Global, all you have to do is go to libertytalk.fm and you can download the Bubba Show every single day. We are now, we just surpassed 225,000 downloads a month and we're trying to get to 300,000. So I need your help. Make sure you get there and download that show. This is The Bubba Show. We're with Dr. Bob Swarup. We'll be back right after the break. The Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horth. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horth with my friend, Dr. Bob Swarup, Camdor Global. smart economist, I'm going to call him. That's my name for you. The smart economist that gets it. Also the author of two great books, and I think one you'll all enjoy would be Money Mania, because that's exactly kind of what's going on here. So, Bob, we see the problem debt. We both identify that. Now, you and I can see it, and everybody else can see it. But see, this is where I have a problem, and this is a fundamental problem in my mind that I can't get past this. I was always a neutral offense sitter. I never was a big fan of the Fed, but I people convinced me on the logic of why it was valuable. But then, now I've watched the last almost 10 years now of what's going on, and they've done nothing but destroy more of the economy, in my opinion. And they don't see the big picture. So why is it like this?
Well, look, I think as we discussed earlier, Todd, I mean, the point is on some debt, but also actually going back to the point you made just before, the problem you have right now is that nobody ever wants the good times to end, right? I mean, an economy is a living, breathing creature. It has a natural cycle. It's like breathing. Go breathe in, go breathe out. There's a natural set of uplifts and downlifts. The recessions, they're booms. The problem is when you try and sustain the boom more and more and more, and you never want the downturn, you just build up a problem for later. It's like going out for a night out, having a great party, putting back all those vodka and tequila shots. And what happens is you have a fantastic time, but come the next morning, you will have the most god-awful hangover in the world. And that's unfortunately what the Fed has done. Most central banks, unfortunately, have the same problem. They are trying very, very hard to sustain a system that actually is not sustainable. And actually, if they were to step back for a second and let the system cleanse itself, it would probably be a lot stronger and a lot better off for it.
I could not agree more. Listen, you're speaking my language. I must have been educated in the same place you were. But so let me ask you. So now you've watched, and you obviously you study global economics. You've seen central banks at work. Now I believe, in my opinion, and I want your opinion. I believe that the central banks are not only in it together, but now they're colluding at ways of manipulating their own currencies at certain times to help one economy and then the other, and that continues to be a thing going on here. I mean, I know, not for a fact, but I read that on February 11th, the bottom of this recent market, that we had this major rally, that Janet Yellen actually called the Bank of England, she called Mario Draghi, and somehow Jamie Dimon from J.P. Morgan bought a lot of stock at the absolute stone bottom of the market. To me, there's some collusion in there. Do I have any basis in my statement? Is there any in your opinion? Is there any fact to that, or am I nuts? I am nuts, but besides it.
I tell you what, I actually think it's interesting, because I think what you're having right now is a move towards what I would call deglobalization. So I think most central banks are right now moving more and more towards their domestic priorities, because ultimately they're elected and fired by the politicians who are in charge in that country. And what happens is every now and then, sporadically, they try and coordinate their efforts, but they always fail miserably. And I'll tell you, some of the scary numbers I look at is this one. So, the JGB, you know, the Bank of Japan's been buying JGBs like anything. They don't really understand financial markets. They don't understand every time they buy the JGB, what they're actually doing is sucking out collateral out of the system, which, by the way, is needed for repos, for swaps, for all sorts of stuff. But they've gotten the point now where they will actually run out of JGBs to buy, because they bought so many. They will become the market. So they're going to have to move forward and look at ETFs and stocks and all sorts of stuff. If you look at Europe, they're buying corporate bonds. In fact, liquidity in the market has gotten so bad now that in April, there was actually a trading session where a 30-year Japanese government bond did not trade hands even once. Can you imagine that? A government bond that for a whole trading session does not change hands even once, because there is no liquid left in the system. What it tells you is that these guys are playing there with their highfalutin concepts on one level. What they don't understand is that fundamental dynamics of financial markets that are the implementation mechanisms of what they play with. Because they haven't understood that, and they're focusing so much on their, you know, domestic unemployment problem, their domestic inflation problem, their political worries, one sort or the other, that they forget the bigger picture. They run this huge, you know, competitive devaluation mechanism. They go down the route of printing more money. And every now and then they wake up, they try and coordinate, but they still miss the fundamental problem in the system, which is that, guys, There's too much debt. The system is broken. You need to reset it. And until you do, things won't get better.
Well, of course, that would be far too logical for the people that are in charge. And that, again, becomes another issue. I find it hard to believe that basically we'd have to assume the smartest people in the world, right? I mean, from an educational standpoint, you know, Janet Yellen and Ben Bernanke before her and the other central bankers have to be some of the most intelligent from a book standpoint. How come they can't understand simple, basic logic that ties in everything? I'm serious. I'm being serious. I know you're laughing, but I'm serious because, I mean, they're smart people. I mean, they went to the major universities. It's not like they got a free pass. And they got appointed to their jobs. How can they not see the simple logic that you just explained to everybody else?
Look, I don't think it's got to do with being smart here. It's got to do with groupthink. You know, there's a wonderful episode in U.S. history called the Seattle Windshield Epidemic, right, which was back in the 1950s. So what you had was in a few small towns outside Seattle, some people began to complain to police that their windshields had been vandalized. When they got to their car in the morning, they found the car had little cracks in the windshield, little dings and so on. The police got worried about an APB, warned everyone, and gradually as more reports became, filtering in, they got more and more worried. They set up roadblocks between towns, but the reports kept increasing. Eventually, there was an airbase nearby that found that six of the cars at the airbase had been vandalized. They shut the whole airbase down, threw the air with a fine-tooth comb, and found no one. At that point, everyone began to believe this wasn't vandalism, but was actually due to something else. And they weren't sure quite what. And the theories were diverse. So for example, the U.S. back then had just done the hydrogen bomb a few years ago. Sputnik had just launched for the first time a year ago. So everyone began to think this was to do with cosmic radiation, it was to do with some unusual stuff about space, you know. Then people began to hypothesize about strange things like, you know, sand flea were laying the eggs and windshields, and as the eggs hatched, the windshield would crack. The whole thing got the point where as the story spread more and more, it eventually got to Seattle. When it got to Seattle, the police got 3,000 complaints in one weekend. The situation escalated to the extent that the governor of the state called the National Guard, declared an emergency, and told the president. They put together a team of crack scientists, got them on the ground, got them to investigate everything. And these guys then reported back, talking about how they were finding strange residues in the windshields, how there were these strange readings and so on. And actually, when they finally finished, what they suddenly realized was the problem was that everyone for all these years had been looking through their windshields. They'd never looked at their windshields. The cracks, the dings had always been there. In fact, because they'd never looked at them, they never noticed them. When they looked at them for the first time, they suddenly noticed all these small cracks in their windshields. They weren't there before in their eyes. And so what they ended up with was this huge mass hysteria where nobody could expect a simple explanation. All these intelligent people kept building up this fantasy that got more and more fantastical just because otherwise they would have had to admit they're just being stupid. And you know what? A lot of it is ego. It is so hard to admit that you might be wrong.
I don't know. I'm wrong all the time, and I freely admit that I'm wrong all the time because that's in my mind and in my eyes the only way you get better is if you fail at something. You learn from that experience, and that's one of the bigger problems I have, Bob, is that we didn't learn from Japan. Okay, we didn't learn that the debacle that they now have. I mean, 41% of their tax base goes to pay back their debt, which is ridiculous. How are they ever going to get past that? And to me, that becomes another problem. But we're going to come back with Dr. Bob Swarup from Camdor Global, also the author of, it must be at a party right now, doing a special interview with us, but also the author of Money Mania, Booms, Panics, and Busts, as well as the author of Asset Liability Management for Finance Institutions. Make sure if you miss an episode of The Bubba Show, you go to libertytalk.fm and you download every day. We've got it available for you with a little bit of a write-up. And also make sure you take the time to check out bubbatrading.com because we do a lot of interesting writing. And our goal, just like having guys like Dr. Bob on the show, is to help you understand markets and how they work better. Because at the end of the day, that's what it's all about, is making you understand better the financial system. This is The Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz. We're with Dr. Bob Swarup from Camdor Global. We will be right after the break. The Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz.
trust. For nearly four decades, that is the reputation Roberts & Roberts Brokerage has forged with their customers. Now, with their full e-commerce website, rrbi.co, it's easier than ever to buy or sell precious metals via Bitcoin or major credit card. Visit them online at rrbi.co or call 800-874-9760 to speak with an experienced professional today. Roberts & Roberts, when you're serious about precious metals.
What's up, everybody? Bubba here. It's finally here, the long-awaited Bubba Report, bringing you news from all the trading floors across the globe. We've got Scott Cialady, the cow guy, as seen on CNBC, Fox, and Bloomberg. We've got Keith Bliss, CNBC, Fox, and a floor trader at the New York Stock Exchange. We've got the Badger, who writes the hot topics in the political news. We got myself putting together my own unique indexes that will help you give you a better idea of what's going on in the market. All you need to do to get a hold of the Bubba Report is go to thebubbashow.org and sign up for the newsletter, or you can email me direct at bubba@thebubbashow.org. We want you to have this report because we've got over 150 years of experience talking about markets, getting ready for the trading, and puts you in the best position to have successful. So email me at bubba@thebubbashow.org to get a copy of your report, or go right to the website, thebubbashow.org. Make sure you get it. It's a must-have for every investor and trader. The Bubba Report.
Welcome back to the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz with Dr. Bob Swarup from Camdor Global, also author of Money Mania, Booms, Busts, and Panics, and how financial institutions take care of themselves. Actually, the actual title is Asset Liability Money Management for Financial Institutions. But obviously, very bright guy, but he's really smart because he agrees with me. No, he's really smart because he gets the whole picture. So Bob, here's another problem I have. Now, you've noticed the retail sales that we've seen in the United States for the past 5 years. They've gone down almost every quarter for 5 years. Okay. Now, my contention is that this whole model that's being run by everybody is really just wiping out the middle class, and that the reason that retail sales stink and are bad, and the reason there is no jobs, because central banks and the banking system does not provide enough liquidity for the average guy, so there's no more entrepreneurship, which means that people aren't making enough money, which means they're not out spending it, which means the middle class is evaporating. What do you say?
Well, I think the middle class is under huge amount of threat anyway. I mean, if you look around, I mean, wage growth in the U.S. has pretty much been stagnant for the last four decades. And there's a simple mathematics about it, which is that if you have inflation every year, but your wage growth isn't going up, well, guess what? You know, technology rescues you only so far. The computer gets cheaper, the broadband gets cheaper, but actually, by and large, you have less and less spending power. And that's what frustration comes from. You know, so it isn't surprising, because, you know, this focus on this 2% inflation target that most central banks have, in many ways makes no sense. I mean, I don't quite know where they picked up the 2% number. It seems like a very nice number to pick out the air. But actually, one could argue that central banks were never in control ever, even in the 80s and 90s and 2000s. Actually, all they were doing was benefiting from the fact that in the 80s, China suddenly came online and began to drive the price of things down. So they had this benign inflation that allowed them to think they were in control. But in reality, the real problem you had, which was that people earning less and less in real terms every year, was completely missed. And now you have a situation where the middle class feels disenfranchised in a big way. So let me give you some inflation numbers. So if you go back to the last 40 years, U.S. CPI is up maybe about four times, you know, 400%, roughly, give or take 20%. However, inflation in terms of college tuition fees, which is something that matters to a lot of people, is up 1,200% over that same period. That's a problem, right? Well, because your inflation went up by four times. Your wage, by the way, went nowhere. And the college bill went up 12 times.
I pay $100,000 a year for two kids in college.
That's my point. These are the kind of economics that ordinary people care about. This is not about, you know, talking about GDP and all this, but this is about simple inflation, which is the stuff that you spend your money on that you care about is getting rapidly more expensive. The stuff you earn isn't going anywhere. And I think the problem is that the Fed, and I would say it's not just the Fed, it's actually policymakers in general, politicians, are all guilty of it. They've completely missed out this fact that, you know, debt can only go so far. I mean, you know, while we could all take out credit cards and mortgages and student loans, it was great. We could keep spending more and more, and it didn't matter. But there has to be a limit. At some point, people start to turn around and say, you know what, even if the bank's not calling me in, I'm worried because I've got so much debt on my balance sheet. People are suddenly walking out of the university with $100,000 in debt, thinking, you know, where's my next job? What do I do? Do I actually have that kind of wage trajectory that my father had?
And that becomes, again, obviously the bigger problem. So let me ask you this question, Dr. Bob. You know, the government's, and I can't speak for everybody, but I can speak for here, the numbers that they report, okay, you know, they always go, well, X food and energy, okay, and X this and X that. Well, why? I mean, in this country, in my opinion, there's a lot of inflation, even though it's not counted, because the things I never buy or I buy every decade, yes, they're not going up. But the things I buy every day, and I know they're more volatile, but they're going up like crazy. I mean, I'm paying now 30% more to fill up my tank again. Okay, I'm paying more for food. Look what's going on in the commodity space. So why can't we recognize that as inflation and raise rates? I mean, I don't know what you think, but my opinion is that they just raise rates and they get them up because that's the only way they're going to free up liquidity. So what? The stock market collapses. Who gives a crap? It'll come back. If the companies are strong enough, they will come back anyways, and there's going to be another collapse either way. What do you say?
But here's the problem. I think it's a problem of lobbying, you know, which is that, in general, you know, this is the thing. The Fed, by the way, all governments are always run by people. People are always going to be much simpler. I mean, you know, the simple analogy I like to use, you know, the world's a very complex place, but our brain's only 3 pounds in weight. You know, the Fed is no different. So, you know, when they're sitting out there trying to decide what they want to prioritize, who are they going to talk to? The corporations, the politicians, the big unions, perhaps? You know, ordinary people get left out of this mix. And that's what, you know, a lot of this mess up comes from. I'll give you an example in the UK. If you look at the UK yield curve, it's actually inverted at the long end. Always has been over the last 20 years. And that inversion is not because of the excessive recession. It is because the long end, the gilt curve, there aren't enough gilts that are sold for the demand that pension funds have to buy them. So what happens is whatever number the government issues, right now it's about $20 billion, there is $200 billion demand at that end. So the number of gilts getting issued get bought out just like that. Now, the government doesn't realize this, never has. However, if you go look at the DMO, the Debt Management Office in the UK, which actually issues all these government bonds, what you'll find is an advisory committee that advises them on the demand in the market. That advisory committee is made up mostly of asset managers. There is a seasonal advisory board for pension funds. There's a seasonal advisory board for insurance companies. Neither pension funds nor insurance companies actually turned up these meetings for a long time. And so what happens is, when they turn around to the advisory board, they ask, what kind of debt should we as a government issue so you guys will buy it? Well, guess what? An asset manager who's buying government bonds, which bear in mind never return much normally, and have a pretty high volatility if you get the duration too long, that guy will turn and always say to you, no matter what you do, you also do, if you issue short-dated bonds and medium-dated bonds, I'll buy them. Long-dated, I don't want to touch those. They're too volatile. And so the government issues what the manager tells them. Unfortunately, the manager is not telling them actually the kind of bonds the client want to buy because the volatility of those bonds is too high and his career risk is too high. If he buys those bonds, he might get fired for holding them. And so this is the irony of it, which is that these guys think they've got a great information system. They think they've collected information. They can't make all these statistics coming out of their ears. But all those numbers, all that complexity they've got coming in still does not capture fundamental things like, as you said, the inflation that you see in your life. You know, there's a project at MIT called the Billion Price Project that actually tries to measure inflation on a normal basis. It tries to look at the inflation of everyday objects. And their inflation, by the way, typically runs much higher than CPI does.
So, I mean, again, it's obviously very frustrating, you know, for everybody. But, you know, it always seems to me that the middle class always gets stuck out in the cold because when this does fail again, we're going to get taxed again, you know, based on having to bail out another problem. And yet we're also taxed by the hidden tax of inflation. and we get texts on the back end. So how does it? How do we ever get into a real system that works? Is it possible?
Well, the middle class, unfortunately, in many ways, never protests enough, right? That's the problem. You know, if you're rich, you lobby. If you're working class, you have trade unions, you agitate. Middle class are these guys who are comfortably in the middle, and therefore they never really get agitated. And that's always been part of the problem. They never had a voice. And it's interesting. If you go and look back at revolutions throughout history, one could always argue that the only successful revolutions in history were the ones where the middle class decided to join the side of the workers. You know, I mean, revolutions are like that. The middle class is a huge swing vote. And while politicians always talk about the middle and appeal to the middle and all the rest of it, I think in many ways they ignore it because they kind of look at the middle and they see it as a very safe bet. But if you look at most governments anywhere in the world, you will always have a left-wing bias in some party and a right-wing bias in another party. The guys who are left-wing biased will always pick up the working class vote because they don't have anybody else to vote for. The guys who are right-wing biased will always pick up the business vote and the upper class vote because those guys, again, have no one else to vote for. And the swing vote in every election, whether it's the US, Brexit, Europe, comes down the middle class. And the problem is that middle class, often I suspect, is taken for granted because it's the one that never has a clear opinion. It's the one that never agitates. And so actually that little bit of inflation is a very small number every year, makes no difference. A little bit of wage suppression, again, makes no difference. But actually it does because, you know, the way we are as people, if our lives don't improve, we get unhappy. And if they get unhappy enough, we go the opposite way. I'll give you an example, which is that I was at dinner with a friend of mine a few weeks ago. And it was just for the London elections for the mayor. And, you know, this guy is well off. He's wealthy. He's had a great career. His son has just gone to university. And we had his son at dinner with his girlfriend. And I asked them who they were voting for in the London mayor election. Now, the two parties out here, the Conservatives, as well as the Republicans, very pro-business, very capitalist, very free markets. And your Labour Party is very much driven by trade unions, very left-wing. Both the son and his girlfriend were voting for the Labour Party, for the guys who are on the sides of workers, higher taxation, etc. Even though they came from a background that was entirely moneyed. But the reason they did it is because they felt frustrated about, in their case, the lack of job opportunities. They felt frustrated about the lack of housing.
Hold that thought, Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob Swarp, Camdor Global, author of Money Mania, Booms and Busts. He's going to finish this story when we come back from the break. This is The Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz. Make sure if you miss an episode, libertytalk.fm will get you there, and you can download it every day. We're going to step out here for a break. We'll be back with Dr. Bob Swarp, Camdor Global, right after the break. The Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz. We're coming right back. Welcome back to The Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz with Dr. Bob Swarp of Camdor Global, as well as a genius economist, because he really knows what he's talking about, and he's not just one of those regular old Bubba economists. Also the author of Money Mania, Booms, Panics, and Busts, as well as Asset Liability Management for Financial Institutions. So you're telling me about the rich dad and the poor kid, and the poor kid's going to go for the labor party. So go ahead and finish your story, Dr. Bob.
Well, the point is that this guy, he comes from a background where he has money. He comes from a privileged background, yet he's voting for the party that is ultimately going to raise taxes, that is going to look at the redistribution of wealth and so on. Why is he doing that? Because he actually feels as if the current government isn't answering his problems. And that's the problem, you see, which is that if you look at the central banks, you look at politicians, as I said, the middle class gets taken for granted very often. And the real danger you have is that it's like thumbscrews, right? It's not painful straight away. But as you keep tightening it year after year after year, it gets to the point where a lot of these guys feel so upset and so angry that they go completely away from you and they go for anything but you. I mean, you look at Europe, okay? You look at Spain, you look at Greece, it's 50% unemployment amongst the youth. What are those guys going to do for their votes? Are they going to vote for a party that might be sensible? Are they going to vote for whoever promises them either to redistribute wealth or to be fascist or something like that? And that's the real thing, which is that these people have got no voice. unfortunately for them, the middle class very rarely stood up and said what it wanted. So they never had a voice, and now it's coming back to roost.
So, I mean, I believe, in my opinion, Dr. Swarup, I believe that the United States will have another revolution. It may not be a gun revolution, but I believe there's a revolution coming, because I believe that eventually the people will rise, because they won't be able to take it anymore, because they are creating too many poor people. And the entitlement system cannot exist forever, as we've seen in every economy that's tried it. Now, of course, we're a little bit bigger, but eventually, I don't care how big you are, you eventually run out of money. Do you have any thought to that?
Well, I think you're already in the middle of it, right? I mean, look at the presidential election. You have, on one hand, Trump. On the other hand, you have the influence, at least, of Bernie Sanders. Both of them are, by the way, representing the angry vote. You know, Trump is very much anti-establishment. You know, Bernie Sanders is redistribution. And what's really interesting is both of them are probably not a million miles apart, in that they both deeply care about protecting American jobs. And, you know, it was interesting because I was in New York a few weeks ago, and what I saw was, you know, probably a dozen Hillary Clinton campaign videos every day. And every single one of them ended up with a warning to American companies that outsource jobs, warning them that they had to watch out, else they'd be punished. You know, the dynamic, the rhetoric, the conversation in the U.S. has changed. I mean, that revolution, as you said, may not be a revolution of guns and bullets, but it's definitely a revolution of attitudes and words, and that's starting to shape up. The real danger you have, by the way, is that a lot of these people, like Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, are only interested in short-term populism. So they'll do what it takes to get elected, they'll do what it takes to get on the bandwagon, but that five-year plan needs for an economy, the five-year plan needs for a country, the 10-year plan, etc., that goes by the wayside. And what you end up with, actually, is probably more isolationism and probably far, far more running away from doing the right thing and just doing whatever it takes to keep people happy. By the way, that's also a recipe for Venezuela.
It's funny because, you know, I wrote about Venezuela about a year ago, saying that this was going to happen. And, of course, it always happens in these situations. And you can't get under control. And again, to me, that has to do with more of the way that the monetary system is run. Are you a fan, Dr. Bob, of the fiat currency system?
Well, I think we've always had it. You know, even when we go back to having gold as a money system, the reality was you never actually had physical gold anyway. If you look back at the system back in the 19th century and before, there was still a fraction of reserving of gold even back then. I think the real danger you've had right now is, and this is a bit that worries me, I think the last maybe half century in the Second World War, we've had a pretty benign period in the world where politics, to a large extent, never mattered. Look at the, you know, the front page and the business page in almost any newspaper in the world. The front page is full of politics and, you know, bombings and all sorts of horrible things happening. The business pages almost never reflect that. And it's because there was this disconnect that evolved, which is probably what also screwed up economists, by the way, which is they all began to believe that somehow the economy lived in this bubble, completely separate from society and politics, and they had to worry about it. In the last 50 years, it's really come back home to roost. What you realize is that, you know, what you think is money doesn't really exist unless people buy into it. Also, what you realize is that no matter what you may do in the real world, sorry, whatever you may do in the monetary world, the real world, what influences you? In other words, you imprint as much money as you like, and your models might tell you it's a great way of solving a problem, the negative rates, all the rest of it. But actually, guess what? In the real world, if people don't like it, they'll tell you, and that will change the system.
So what is the solution, in your opinion? What would you, if you were in charge, what would you do?
Well, I wish I stopped a long time ago, but in today's world, the solution is quite simple on one level, which is you need large-scale debt forgiveness of one sort. You need to restructure the debt around the world. You need to put up with a lot more bankruptcy. However, that bankruptcy at this stage is no longer purely individual bankruptcies or a corporate one. It's probably a sovereign one. I mean, Greece, for example, is bankrupt. Spain is bankrupt. The only problem is no one's recognized it yet. We are much better off turning around and saying, you know what, you guys are bankrupt. Let's figure out, let's have a couple of hearings, let's have a creditors committee, let's work on a solution to this. Let's work out the best way of paying people back, whatever we can, and then we can rebuild the economy with a clean slate. If you could do that, before they get growth again. If you're in the U.S., you have similar problems in terms of, you know, student loans and areas like that. Well, you know, you look at what Sallie Mae has. I mean, a lot of those loans are never going to get paid back. Yet somehow they're perversely hanging around with a very large number, and you may as well turn around and restructure it right now before it gets to the point where you restructure it catastrophically.
Well, you know, there's so much to be done, but again, it's debt forgiveness. I mean, you know, we forgave all that debt many, many times. And again, and we forgave all the banks, basically, and all these companies. I mean, from my point of view, I'm tired of forgiving the debt because I get the benefit of getting to pay for it. I mean, is there not a better solution?
It's not that. You know, the whole thing is that if you look at what happened to the banks, you didn't really have debt forgiveness. What you had is a huge bailout of the banks, the extent of the net. What I'm talking about here is you taking a look across the debt of a country, of a society, and you're saying, you know what, this stuff can't be repaid. I mean, student loans, bear in mind, it's not banks. It's actually ordinary people.
Right.
You go look across at, you know, what's owed in Greece or Spain, whatever. You know, and the problem here you have is that, you know, if you were lending money to, you know, Global Crossing or Enron or these guys, you know, you knew you're not going to get the money back. And the longer you dragged it out, the more problematic it began. In fact, if you had admitted a long time ago you were not going to get the money back and you restructured it, you probably would have ended up with more of your money back than if you hadn't. The people who actually probably suffer in this scenario, to be fair, is not individuals, by the way. It's probably going to be insurance companies. It's probably going to be banks. It's probably going to be pension funds. It's probably going to be corporates. But, you know, the reality is that if you have a system where there's too much debt, the answer is simple. It has to have less debt. If it has to have less debt, that means there's a whole amount of debt that has to be destroyed, written off, or repaid. If that last option is not possible, because it's not today, then you either write it off or you destroy it. Destroying it is, by the way, what the Great Depression was. Writing it off is what the Brady bombs were, a restructuring. So it's a choice. My worry is that the way politicians usually work, they're always the right thing, but only on the round of all of the options. And usually by that stage, it's always too late.
Dr. Bob Swarup, Camdor Global, author of Money Mania, Booms and Busts. Thank you. It's always great to have you on, and I appreciate your candor and your honesty and the way you think about things. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Todd.
This has been Dr. Bob Swarup from Camdor Global, as well as the author of a couple of books, one of them being Money Mania, Booms and Busts. I urge you to check them out. This is The Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horowitz. That will do it for today. Make sure you go to libertytalk.fm and download the podcast every single day. We'll see you back here tomorrow, same time, same station, The Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horowitz. Have a great day, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. We'll see you later.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.